Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this Thursday, the 10th of September, Animals John Katz writes in his latest book, have enriched my life and shaped my understanding of one of the most debated and compelling questions in the long history of human beings' relationships with animals. Do they have souls? And if so, what might they be? He quotes James Thurber. Actually, every new chapter of this book has a wonderful quote. James Thurber, if I have any beliefs about immortality, it is that certain dogs I have known will go to heaven and very, very few persons. I hope that's not the case in many of your lives, that we'll all go there. John Katz is with us this hour. Author most recently of Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. John writes columns and about rural life for Slate. He has written for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Rolling Stone, co-host of Dog Talk on Northeast Public Radio. He lives on Bedlam Farm in upstate New York with his dog, sheep, steers, and cow, donkeys, barn cat, rooster, and three hens. He's written many other books, and we've talked to him about these. Izzy and Lenore, a wonderful book. Dog Days, A Good Dog, Cats on Dogs, The Dogs at Bedlam Farm, The New Work of Dogs, and the list goes on. And we've had the great pleasure of interviewing John many times over the past few years. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org. Hello, John.
Hello, Kathleen. Thank you for having me on again.
Oh, yeah, a great pleasure. I can't believe I missed the HBO special. It was on September 3rd, but it'll be repeated, I assume.
I guess so. It'll be repeated on DVD, but you get the real thing, though.
The last time I talked to you, they were going to be doing the movie, and I want to know how you liked it.
Well, it's very strange. You know, I think I don't have a good perspective on it. Of course, I looked at it. I thought, why is Jeff Bridges walking around in my clothes? So I didn't. I thought, you know, the John Katz in the movie, I think, is, I don't see a lot of myself in that, but I thought it was a kind of lovely look at the impact of a dog on a person's life.
Mm-hmm.
The Jeff Bridges John Katz was, you know, pretty depressed and ticked off. But it was fun. You know, it was fun. I just look at it and kind of scratch my head. I said, what are they doing? You know,
what are they doing? And you have a chapter about, I didn't know this, they had five dogs who were coming to play Orson, and they were all groomed and had contact lenses in, et cetera?
They had contact lenses. They did their braids. They had they sprayed them to look alike. They had imported sardines from Europe. And they had a trailer came every morning to kind of gussy them up. And I had learned how they get movie dogs to like a movie star. They stick hot dogs in his ear. And there was an aide who walked around with a bucket of chicken broth, who painted chicken broth on his face. Got the dogs to love him that way.
Oh, that's quite.
It was a very strange experience, I have to say. Talk about an out-of-body experience.
Yeah, I'll bet it was an out-of-body experience. Well, it's another great book. Yeah,
I
love your writing. You're really good.
Thank you very much.
I guess we ought to start with Rose. Rose has been such a big part of your life and really makes your life on the farm possible in many ways, doesn't she?
Yes. I think, you know, I'm realizing, becoming more aware that, you know, Rose is a mythical story in my mind, and I think I present her that way. I figured out over time that Rose is really what made me feel safe enough to be on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the real trouble, she handles it all. And seems to know what to do, and works very well with me and understands me. And just a couple of weeks ago, we were out riding on the ATV, and I came across a fawn who was trapped in my pasture fence. Had been struggling all night, and it was very hard to get her out of there. She was kicking at me, and I couldn't get close enough, and Rose sort of came in. We've been working together for years, and she cut to the far side of her and turned her head away and distracted her while I came in and slipped the latch off the gate. And I was thinking, you know, I feel like I really need Rose to survive, and that's probably not true. I mean, a lot of farmers don't have Rose, and they do all right. But in my mind, her impact on me was such that it really made it possible for me to be there. You know, she's actually, I don't know if you know, but she's inspired a real change in my work life. I'm doing a novel It's called Rose in a Storm.
No, I didn't know that.
And it's written, I'm turning to fiction, and it's written from the perspective of a border collie who is abandoned on a farm during an awful blizzard. And I actually wrote it from the dog's point of view, which was intensely difficult. I call it the rubber book because my editor keeps sending it back to me. But it was a very thrilling experience to put yourself inside the head of a dog who has all this responsibility and has to figure out what to do when she's left without humans. So I was figuring out how to narrate a story in a character that has no language was quite exciting.
I would imagine. And you talk about that she's not really the sweetest dog, not the kind of dog that most people want. She's not there to put her head on your lap or crawl into bed with you, give you that unconditional love, but she works. She's a worker.
She's a worker, and she's also, unlike a lot of dogs, Rose has been making decisions all of her life. You know, she's never been walked on a leash. She is out there with the sheep and confronting wild animals. And we were up the other day, and she ran into a bunch of 10 pigs from a neighbor's farm. Running around. And she's making decisions and choices all the time. And that has allowed her to evolve with me in a very particular way. Most people don't get in a situation where their dogs can make many decisions. They're walking them on leashes. They feed them. So for Rose, I've seen her evolve in a quite remarkable way, and she understands me and the farm in a particular way, and I've seen her strategize and problem solve and figure things out, and that instinct in her has really evolved.
Mm-hmm.
That's been very exciting to watch.
Yeah, I imagine. Tell us about the night that, the Borning night, and I think HBO was there at the time.
The which night now?
The Borning night of the...
Oh, the lambing night.
Right.
Yes. That's a Midwestern term, Borning. We were out there with the lambs, and the lambs were starting to give birth. Rose and I were out there all night, and she was going up and alerting me to the lambs being born and keeping them with their mothers and pushing them back to me so we could get them in a lambing pen. It went on, and by dawn, the two of us were just exhausted, lying covered in mud and crud next to the fence. And then these gussied up border collies from the movie appear alongside the fence, all looking perfumed and sweet smelling and bright eyed. And it was really funny because I think Rose just hated these dogs. And she just went after them. It was just like too much. It was too much. And she doesn't really pay attention to other dogs, but she just said, I can't stand this. And ran them off. She didn't want them nowhere near us. But Rose is a funny dog because she, when people come to the farm, I always ask them what dog of mine would they like, do they most like. They almost never say Rose because Rose is not, coming up and cuddling them or sitting in their lap or doesn't chase toys or balls and doesn't care about treats. So people don't really, she doesn't trigger that sort of gene that dogs do when they look at you and get in your lap. But she's a quite remarkable creature. She is a tremendous work ethic. She's incredibly faithful and determined. And it's probably not really true that I couldn't live there without her, but it feels like that, which is kind of, to me, her soul, really.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing to me the kind of really hard work and soulful work that you have to do on this farm. That night as well, you thought that there were going to be deaths. The lamb wasn't going to be able to make it, and miraculously did, and you had to pull the lamb out. And this is really hard work that you're doing as well.
It's very hard work. I'm actually thinking about selling the farm because I want to get a smaller place.
Really?
Yeah, I think it's... I'm also doing children's books as well as fiction. And I need more time to do my creative work. I'm also taking a lot of pictures. I'm into photography, too.
Mm-hmm.
And the physical prospect of managing the farm and the animals has become overwhelming. This winter was a brutal winter, and it was hard to get my work done. And now that I'm doing a trilogy of books kind of inspired by Rose, and I'm doing three children's books for Holt McMillan, and I just feel like I need a place that's just a little easier to manage.
Mm-hmm. Well, what will happen to Elvis?
Well, Elvis will find another place. He'll find another place to go. It's time for all 3,000 pounds of him.
3,000 pounds, John?
He's a big bean. Maybe 2,700, I think.
Oh, my gosh. Are you still doing the Snickers?
No, I haven't done the Snickers in a while. But he gets plenty of hay. He gets Dunkin' Donuts. He gets chocolate donuts every now and then.
All right, there you go. But he probably misses the Snickers.
Yeah, I bet he does.
I bet. You talk about food in your animals, that which I think is good for everybody to know, that the way you first approach them is food. You know, that's what makes them tick in many ways. They want their food.
Well, I think a big sub-theme of the book has been my increasing feeling that we're personifying animals too much. We're emotionalizing them. We're anthropomorphizing.
Yep.
We love them so much that we are wanting them to be more and more like us. So we're talking about what they think and what they feel, and we're ascribing a lot of our emotions to them. And one of the things you learn being on a farm, being with these animals, dogs in particular, is a lot of their emotional lives are really driven by food. And they tend to love who feeds them. And that's why that they get to sleep in bed and raccoons don't. Because they really have figured us out. And it's very important. I mean, I think all the success I've had, the affection I get with the animals, derives from the fact that I feed them. They're very happy to see me, and they keep a close eye on me, and they know me well. And I think that's important to understand. I think when people talk about unconditional love, you know, what's really happening on the animal end usually is, you know, we're taking care of them, we're feeding them. And they, over the years, have figured that out. And the way to get fed with us is that's why dogs do so much better than squirrels. Squirrels have not figured that out. Some have, I guess some squirrels have. But I think it's very important, you know, I think the way to communicate with an animal is very often food. And food is what grounds them and attaches them to us, and a lot of their lives revolve around it. If you read these behavioral studies on why people love dogs and cats, you see that these animals have figured out, they've evolved living with people for thousands of years, and they know how to get us to take care of them, and that's one of their great geniuses. And it's a very interesting thing to accept, because it's not often what people want to hear. They want to hear, I'm going to know he loves me because I'm just a wonderful person. But the truth is, you know, Rose doesn't get up in the morning and say, gee, I really like John, so I'm going to work with him. You know, that's her instincts, very powerful instincts to work with someone and do this kind of work. To me, that's the beginning of understanding our relationship with them. Mm-hmm. When we start thinking they're cute, they're childlike, you know, they love us, then I think you begin to lose a track of what they're really like. And that often causes troubles for them, and I think clouds these whole questions of souls and spirits.
Mm. And yet, you've written about some of the most soulful, almost spiritual work in the hospice work you've done with Izzy, particularly, that just brings tears to your eyes. There's some other kind of connection that dogs can bring out in somebody, some life that people thought wasn't existent anymore.
Well, I think there's a part of animals have a powerful impact on human beings, and I think that particularly people in the suburbs and urban areas of America who are disconnected from the natural world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's something we need. I think it's, you know, we need contact with them. We need to be around them. And I think when we're not around them, I think we get disturbed, lonely, and anxious. So I see when you go into a nursing home or a hospice home where someone's dying with Izzy, I just see people light up. They could be having the worst imaginable day, be in discomfort and be unhappy. And they see the dog come in there, and they're just, a big smile pops out, and it just lifts them up. And I can't say I know exactly why. I think it touches something very deep in us. You know, being in a rural area, I see the difference. You know, people on the farms grow up around animals. And I think there is something very grounding about it. I think it's really something we need. And people turn to it, and it really shapes them and affects them if they're open to it.
Right. So let's talk about dogs going to heaven. You meet people all the time, you say, who tell you in considerable detail what their dogs and cats are thinking, feeling, and planning, and who find the very idea that their companion animals might be barred from heaven heretical.
Well, it's very interesting. You know, I had never read Plato or Aristotle or Socrates before, because the thought of it gave me a headache, kind of. But to do this book, I realized, you know, all of the great writers through time have addressed this question. You know, Aquinas and St. Augustine, Aristotle, Plato. They wrote voluminous tracts about animals and souls. It's always been a question that's fascinated human beings. It doesn't seem to fascinate the animals, but it fascinates the people. and when you see this writing, especially of the early Christian theologists, you know, and these Christian writers were really the first nonfiction writers in the world. and they were really kind of explaining the world for the first time. And to all of them, including the philosophers, the human soul was precious. It was sacred. Human beings, in their minds, were unique because we have consciences and we can change our lives and we can invent democracy and culture and theater. And animals were, of course, you know, food or just beasts of burden.
Right.
And the Bible said we have dominion over them. So almost all of the Christian theologies were, and the Greek philosophers were very clear about separation between a human and an animal soul. Excuse me. What you see in reading those people is very interesting. They worshiped the human spirit, and they thought animals were kind of dumb. Sorry. In our time, it seems to have reversed itself. I think we almost worship animals, and we're very disappointed in people.
Mm-hmm.
And that change. I have a cold, as you can see.
I'm sorry.
I'll be good in a minute.
Okay.
That change is really very striking when you read all the literature, because we seem very disappointed in people, and we almost seem to be worshiping animals. You know, it's very interesting when you track things like the Michael Vick story. You know, what Michael Vick did, which was pretty appalling, but it was not even illegal 50 years ago. And the fury and outrage about it speaks a lot to how we have evolved in our view of animals and their place in the world. You know, there are three murderers in the NFL, and no one has squawked about them being there.
Right, exactly.
So our feelings about animals are intensifying, and I think we're coming to love them more and more, even as we're disenchanted with a lot of people and people institutions.
We're going to take phone calls for you, John, and we'll do that in a moment. Let you take a moment here and get some water or whatever. Well, here's our number. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. John Katz is our guest. He has a new book, and it is Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. Some of you may have had a chance to see the film version of A Dog Year, one of his other books. It was on HBO just last week, I think, and I missed it. So I know they repeat things. I hope to see it. So you can give us a review of that as well. This book, it looks, you know, it catches us up on all the animals on the farm, the donkeys and the roosters and the cats and the sheep and all the wonderful dogs and looks at this question of whether or not animals have souls and the role that animals are playing in our contemporary lives. And he just has great insights about all of the lovely creatures who live with him. So we'll take some phone calls in a moment. We also have an email address. You can tap into that by going to talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we go to phone calls now for John Katz, whose latest book is Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. And Dee from Green Bay is our first caller. Hi, Dee.
Hi, good morning to both of you. I've just wanted to make a couple of comments. I was in a serious car accident a while ago in 98, and when I was brought home from the hospital, Asa, my dog, when they brought her to where I was staying at my mother's house, she came flying through the house. I had casts, almost in a full body cast. She squarely jumped on top of me, and everybody was freaking out. And she started licking the places where I had fractured my left arm, my right knee. So there's that. And I'm sure that maybe it's an olfactory sense that she knew. But she wouldn't leave for 6 months, she wouldn't leave my sight. I have a Papillon now who is the same way. When I feel sad or I'm excited about something, she won't leave me alone. She'll be licking on my arms, and if I'm crying, she's licking on my face, and she watches me all the time. Sometimes I just have to get out of the room because she's just watching me. So I just like to hear the speaker's comments on that. And anyway, where is that connection coming from? Thanks.
Thank you, and thanks for the call. You know, I think that the challenge here is to is to understand how an animal's mind works, especially a dog. And remember that they don't have language. So the dog is really not capable of looking at you and saying, well, you know, you're hurt and I'm sorry about that. They do have these phenomenal instincts, much of which we don't really understand. So I think it's well within the range of a dog to smell or sense or feel pain or injury, certainly to read emotions if you're distressed or unhappy. Whether they can spot fractures or not, I don't know. I've come to appreciate, you know, the way dogs really think, and if you talk to behaviorists, I think there's a lot of agreement about it. They have a stream of sensory images running through their mind, much like a microprocessor of a video game. And these images would pop up, and they would and their instincts would provoke responses. So a dog would see a person they're attached to come home, be in a cast, be in a different position, be moving differently, feeling differently, on medication, and all kinds of things, smell, sight, would trigger anxiety, concern, even affection or protectiveness. I think the way to see it, the danger of seeing dogs as being, you know, to being consciously healing or self-aware, is that you can easily misinterpret the behavior, because the smaller dog who's looking at you all the time could also be nervous or hungry or know that you feed him. And I think what we need to do is often look at our own behavior. We often reinforce behaviors that we like, and in terms of whether we feed the dog or look at the dog. And if you're not aware of your own emotional happenings, you know, that's usually what's going on. It's getting the dog to react to it back and forth. It's a mutual thing. So it doesn't mean it's not real. It doesn't mean it doesn't feel good. It doesn't mean the dog, you know, it's not great. But I think it's important to take our words and language and emotions out of it. When people say a dog is happy or sad or worried, these are very human emotions. And animals don't usually feel those things. They don't ever feel those things, really.
Yeah.
It looks like it does, but I think that's the challenge. And it's interesting writing the book. I think the soul of a dog is the impact they have on us, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. You write about, it runs throughout the book, but I'm just finding a paragraph here. When I'm sick, Rose, your dog, one of your dogs, will not leave my side voluntarily, not to eat, go out, eliminate. What is she sensing? What is she doing? And then you talk about... this loyalty, empathy, and intuitiveness being closer to getting at what animals might really be feeling or sensing. They do have this intuitiveness, don't they?
Yeah, yes, and intuition is one of the keenest of animal instincts, sort of sense of when something is wrong or different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, dogs are believed to carry a map in their heads of how things ought to be. And when things are not that way, especially a working dog, I had some spinal trouble, you know, fell down and had some spinal injury. And I couldn't go out really walk for a while. I had to hire a dog walker. And Rose just wouldn't go without me. And I had to crawl down to the back door and open the door to let her out. And I remember talking to behaviorists about it, what's going on with her. And he said, well, she's not sitting there in the morning saying, gee, I'm concerned about John's back. But she could be well aware that you're in pain or discomfort. You're moving differently.
Right.
And so her instinct would be to be protective of that. And to pay attention and stay close, it would be upsetting to her.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of distress and concern could, you know, we translate it as, oh, my God, she's really worried about me, because that's what we want to hear. And it looks the same, and the consequence is almost the same. But the thought process could really be quite different, really.
Thanks, Dee, for your call. We go to Alice from Milwaukee next. Hi, Alice.
Oh, hi. I hope you can catch me. I'm on the freeway, and sometimes the cell phone doesn't work so well. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
I'm an equine veterinarian, and I also do a lot of equine chiropractic. And a lot of my clients' horses, I never feed them, and they're so thrilled to see me. So, and in horse culture, they don't share food with one another because it's everywhere. You don't have to go catch it like dogs do. So giving a horse a treat is something that we teach them is fun. But they don't give each other treats in their own culture. What they do is they scratch each other's bug bites and rub each other's and lick each other's sores and, you know, find sore places to chew on one another and switch flies. And they'll stand next to each other as mutual buddies and do this for one another. And I think depending on the species is where they're motivated, because these horses really like me coming, and it's strictly because I'm giving them a lot of immediate physical comfort. They know who I am and what I do, and they think it's great. So I think you have to look into the value of food in the animal culture. Dogs share food because it's a lot of work to find it in the wild. You know, they got to go kill something or find something dead and drag it home. Whereas a horse, you know, if they give each other food, that's like giving your girlfriend a rock off the parking lot. Like, so what? You know, she wants a diamond because that's a valuable thing. So food isn't that valuable for horses compared to dogs as far as whether they like you or not. I mean, they'll win because you're bringing them food, but it's not because they necessarily love you.
Right. John?
Well, my donkeys sure love food, I have to say that. Well, you know, everybody has a different experience and perspective on it. I think, you know, 30 years ago, the Harvard Medical School did a study on whether Americans thought their animals had souls or not, and only 2% said yes. And 3 years ago, they did the same study, and 98% said, of course, they have souls.
Ooh.
So this was a complete reversal in the generation, really, of Americans' view of animals and spirituality. And for me, what was interesting about the book, really, is this question of why has this changed? Why are we so preoccupied? Why was an idea that was considered ridiculous 30 years ago is now so universal that it's really hardly even in dispute? And I think it has to do with human need. I think Americans are very disconnected from each other and very stressed and under a lot of pressure. You know, technology doesn't quite work. Religion's under siege. Politics is very divisive. And I think when they come home and they see that dog or that cat and they perceive it as this unconditional, dependable, reliable love that's really all about them, they need that. And so they're making it true. Now, whether animals are literally, you know, you have a religious and a secular approach. You know, there's no religion, really, other than possibly Buddhism, that accepts the idea that animal and human souls are equivalent. Certainly not in the Christian faith, although there's some dissent now about that. So I think it's a secular idea. We love these dogs. We want them to come with us. We want the cats to go with us when we go.
Sure.
And I think it's very hard to separate. I mean, I feel like we're losing perspective because we want to see them as being so loving and so supportive of us that we're kind of forgetting sometimes that they're animals. And I know, I'm sure, respect the vets work with horses, but I think animals are very food driven, and I think that's a key element to their emotional attachment.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's also this is just a simple thing in my life every day, but I was just thinking about it, that the amount of happiness an animal can give you is just extraordinary. I go home, and my dog, you know, who's just a wild dog that... just not very disciplined or anything, but he's such a happy dog, and he just grabs onto my leg. It's like he's giving me this huge hug, and he'll stand there for a good 4 minutes just hugging me in the way that a dog can. I'm thinking, yeah, it doesn't get much better than this sometimes, you know. This is okay. This person is really, really happy to see me. That's great.
It is great, and I think you're also, you have, remember, you have two elements going on here. You have the person and the dog, and they're going back, they're trading back and forth with each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're probably happy to see him too.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always tricky to try to figure out who's reinforcing what.
Right.
Because quite often when people are attributing to dogs, it's really coming from us.
Right.
You know, you're excited to see him, and you're excited. And you're happy, and that's something you need at the end of a work day, which is great. Now, that doesn't make it any less for me. It doesn't make it less meaningful. But I think we're in danger of losing a little bit of perspective in our rush to attribute all of these amazing qualities to animals. I think we need to be careful that we're not losing sight of them as animals,
mm-hmm.
and that animals just have a different range of emotions. They certainly think, and of course they have souls, and they certainly... have affection and attachment. It just doesn't work the way we think it does in our own language. I think that's the problem.
Yeah, right. Well, I sure hope they're around if we go to heaven, if there is one. Don't you? I'd love to see all those dogs.
Well, I had a Baptist minister come to the farm to help.
Oh, that's a great chapter. Yeah,
Dr. Reverend Wrightbread, and he came and went right up to Lulu, one of my donkeys, and he said, Lulu, he said, do you accept Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior? And she kind of looked at him. She was looking for a cookie. And my equines are very interested in food. And he said, you're not going to heaven. And he said he was a very interesting afternoon because very nice man. And he said, I'd love to tell people their dogs are going to heaven and their horses, and their, but I can't say that because there's only one way to go to heaven if you're kind of Christian that I am. So he was being faithful to his creed.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you don't go to heaven because you're cute. And then this is the theological approach. You know, the secular definition that I used was really the spirit of an animal. It doesn't involve religion, really. And I don't know, you know, I don't reach a conclusion in the book. Obviously, I'm not here to tell anyone. I'm not that crazy. I wouldn't tell anybody their dogs are not going to heaven. But I think I think what's interesting is why we need them to go. And you just said, you know, you want your dog to be with you.
Right.
And that's I wonder if that would have been true 30 or 40 years ago, if you would have felt that way.
Hmm.
Maybe you would have, but it was not a widely held belief 30 or 40 years ago. And if you go back further to Plato's time, the idea would have been considered lunatic.
Right.
Why would you want a dog to go to heaven? So it's a very new idea, and it's become a more intense idea in recent times than ever before. And I think that's what's so interesting about it.
Yeah. I love the picture of Lulu in the book. Who's Lulu with? I'm just looking at it now, where they're sort of nuzzling each other.
I'm not sure who she's with there. She's with another donkey, right?
Yeah.
No, that was Fanny. She's with Fanny.
Did
you, you know, I had a lot of fun with the barn cat chapter, Mother.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Tell it.
And I think that story is great about in this context because a friend of mine told me that loves her cats, a real cat person, and has three or four cats and is crazy about them. And she said her cats were just like children to her. And, she, you know, there's one cat in particular she kept saying it's just like a child. So I realized I didn't know enough about cats. So I spent Christmas Day afternoon observing Mother, my barn cat. And I got quite an education into cats. I thought to myself, it's like watching Ted Bundy. This is like a serial killer. And she went out and dismembered, tortured, killed, like I can't even count the number of things, and then sat in my lap and purred and wanted to be scratched. So, you know, she's not doing anything wrong. She's just being a cat. And she's being true to her nature. But it reminds me, of course, they're not like us. You know, they're very different from us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we had a child doing that, we'd be very concerned.
Right.
But if for a cat to do it, it's just being very natural.
Yeah, right. Thanks, Alice, for the call. Artis is next from Delafield. Hi, Artis.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've had animal companions my entire life, and I don't have the conventional idea of heaven and hell, but I do believe that anything that's living has a place, you know, and that, you know, living and the whole living and death is a physical, there is a component, and we just don't understand it yet, but so I'll leave it at that. I do have some interesting animal stories. I have two that I'd like to share. One is my Rottweiler, Tegan. One day I had a really bad, long history of diabetes, and I had an insulin reaction, and it happened while I was asleep. So, you know, I woke up, and Tegan had been licking my face, just licking, licking, licking. And when I woke up, I was obviously quite weak and could barely move, but, you know, I was able to get my insulin pump off and get to the candy in my drawer barely. But, you know, that kind of, it was very harrowing, and I kind of felt like, had she not woken me up, I don't know what would have happened. The other thing is, in watching my animals, I have two cats and two dogs. I find the most pleasurable thing is just watching them and how they interact with each other and the differences in their personalities. For instance, and this is my last story, Molly, who is, I have a 14-year-old tortoiseshell cat, appears to me, as far as cats go, very intelligent. She's very controlling. She's like a, you know, a mega athlete, so she's still in very good shape. And she is just, you know, kind of like what I like to think of as a marine commando. She patrols the house, keeps the dogs in line. She even once went up, when we first got my dog, she went up to the dish and took out a, you know, big pellet of food, bit it, spit it out, did that two more times, and walked away. And I'm not sure what the meaning of that was. I can, you know, put all my, we have lots of, you know, funny things that we had, like saying that she was showing the dog what was going to happen, you know, if he ever crossed her path. That, but I know that's probably way off. But I just think it's interesting just to see how they interact.
Oh, yes. John?
Well, I think it is interesting. You know, I certainly think it's well within the range of a dog's skills to notice somebody having a, you know, an insulin reaction. You know, if you change, your body changes, your manner changes, and to be concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am concerned a little bit when I hear stories all the time of dogs and cats saving people's lives, and I think we have to be careful not to put too much pressure on them. You know, most dogs are not paramedics. You know, and they're not going to save your life, and it can happen, and it does happen, I'm sure, and it's wonderful when it happens. But more and more, I hear these stories of people who are seeing their dogs as saviors and spiritualists and empaths and psychics and best friends and therapists. You know, it's a new role, and it's a lot of pressure to put on an animal. I think you know, there's no question that they can. I see Izzy do it all the time in hospice work, very sensitive to medications and other things on people. But at the same time, I think we have to be careful not to lose perspective so completely that we stop seeing them for what they are. And I think by and large, you know, we all have stories I hear all the time about somebody died and the dog starved to death or pined away, and everybody has a story like that. But in general, you know, most dogs are rehomed really quite happily. The Katrina dogs, rescue dogs all the time. Dogs are very adaptable creatures. And I try in my own life, I guess the only way I can put it, in my own life, to not put that kind of responsibility on them. You know, Rose is great, but she's not responsible for my life.
Hmm.
And I am. And I don't want to put more pressure on her than is already there. You know, I think she just, you know, she's a great working dog and has a great impact on my life. But I'm concerned about what I sort of see as a tidal wave of kind of emotional feelings about animals saving us and knowing us and understanding us. And it's a lot of pressure on them right now. And I think a lot of dogs are suffering. There are 400,000 dogs on Prozac right now in America.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, for separation anxiety and issues relating to grief and people's concern about them being nervous and leaving them. And I just think we just have to be cautious about it, because I think we are in danger of making dogs a little crazy. And, you know, they're simple creatures. They're traditional creatures. And I think we can lose track of them. Without, you know, why did dogs go 20,000 years without Prozac, you know, and now they all need it?
Right.
So it worries me a little bit.
Yeah, I see your point. Artis, thanks for the call. Lori is next from Stillwater, Minnesota. Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have a comment that when you mentioned that we have to not lose sight of the fact that they are animals, it made me think of, I think we need to also not lose sight of the fact that we are also animals. And I think human beings like to put ourselves above everything, every other living creature in the world. And I think the rest of the natural world is just still connected to that deep instinct, that deep knowing that we have by and large lost. And you mentioned, why have dogs survived all this time without Prozac, or why have we survived all this time until fairly recently without all of these crutches and Prozac and type of things too. I think we've lost connection with the natural world that they still are connected to, and indigenous peoples, by and large, I think, recognize types of things like this.
I think that's a wonderful point, and I think it's absolutely true and also very documentably true. You know, there are a lot of, I think a lot of people, especially in America, are what I would call existentially lonely, which is the term I use for what you're talking about. They're disconnected from the natural world. They're disconnected from the animal world. They're disconnected from their roots and history, and it causes a tremendous amount of anxiety and disorientation. And I think it's one reason why so many people are turning to animals so intensely right now to try to reconnect with exactly what the caller is talking about. And I think where I land with this question is, it's not that we're better or worse than them, but that there just are enormous differences. And I think just our ability to have this conversation is what is unique to human beings, because animals don't have those conversations. They don't say, okay, where are we in the world, and Are we going to change? And what about our consciences? And it doesn't make them worse than us. It makes them, in some respects, probably simpler and easier.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, I think it's important to preserve what is, you know, what is sacred about both. And I think the fact that animals don't do that, they don't go on cable talk shows and scream at each other. They don't sue each other, and they don't, you know, they not naturally would never take Prozac. And we're all running around stressed out and buying AIDS and CDs and meditating and visualizing all day. And it's, we need those things because we're very, very disconnected. And I think that's a very, very important point. That's what I mean when I say so much we can learn from them. And they soothe us and they help us. They remind us, I think, of where we come from. And then the parts of us that are still there, as the caller is pointing out. So I think it's a very, very important point. And I think I even address it in the book. I think it's very, very true.
John Katz, our guest this hour, his new book is Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. The number is 800-486-8655. The email, we have one of those we'll read after this pause, is talk@WPR.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to an email for you, John. This is, listening to you talk about Rose, I'm reminded of Jesse, a border collie we had to put down this summer after 14 years. We don't live on a farm, but your description of Rose's personality reminded me of Jesse, loyal, trusting, dedicated to the end, not particularly interested in hugs and cuddles. Her play was to work, and indisputably smarter than many of her people counterparts. She was the caretaker of the family. Did she have a soul? Oh, yeah, a gentle spirit, smart and caring, blessing our family with her presence, and she remains a part of us all.
Well, that's very nice. I think that, you know, I think that often is the soul of a dog, really, is just the place they had in our lives and our feelings about them and the feelings that they generate and provoke. You even hear from the calls today just how much animals mean to people. And I think that that is the very, very important work they're doing, I think, is keeping these parts of us engaged and alive and feeling loved. I think that's a nice message.
Yeah, it is. Susan from Bristol. Hi, Susan.
Good morning. Thank you for having this show. This is wonderful.
Thank
I can
you.
Just eat this kind of thing up. I want to make a quick comment. Good morning to all of you. Anyway, the previous caller mentioned something about how we try to put ourselves on pedestals and don't think of us, ourselves as animals, which is preposterous. We're not the fastest. That's the cheetah. We're not the largest. That's the blue whale. We're not the oldest lived. That's, I think, a tortoise, or it might be a parrot. But there are tons of things. Dogs can smell and have night vision better than we do. We're not the best at everything just because we can knit a sweater, write a poem, and make a skyscraper. But that's just a quick comment. Anyway, what I called is about what you were talking about the people's religious views, how they vary, about how they look at animals and whether they have souls and such. And I have pictures that I could send you. But there is this, and I hope nobody gets mad at me, but there is this Catholic and a Presbyterian church that were directly across the street from each other. And they had a little bit of a competition with their signage in front of the church. And first, the Catholic church put out a sign that said, "All dogs go to heaven." The Presbyterian church put out one that says, "Only humans go to heaven, read the Bible." The Catholic church put out one that said, "God loves all his creatures, dogs included." Presbyterian church said, "Dogs don't have a soul. This is not open for debate." Then the Catholic church put out, "All Catholic dogs go to heaven. Presbyterian dogs can talk to their pastor." The Presbyterian church put out, "Converting to Catholicism does not automatically guarantee one a soul." The Catholic Church put out, "Free dog souls with conversion." I had to share that.
That's great.
If you want, I can email you the pictures.
Yeah, that'd be great. I'd like to. It's Dunk@WPR.org.
Okay.
All right. Thanks very much.
Have a wonderful day.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for the call. All right, let's go to Kathy from Onalaska. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I have a cat I adopted from the Humane Society, of course. He was a long-term cat. Nobody wanted him. He was 2.5 at the time. And my daughter keeps saying, this is a dog in cat's clothing. He loves to go walking on a leash. He's friendly with everybody, even little kids that run and scream. And I have a friend who just turned 100 years old who loves cats but can't take care of one. So I thought I'd take her over to see Helen. He loves riding in the car. And actually, the last time I took him, he stepped on the window opener and lowered the back window so he could look out like a dog. But he goes over to Helen's place and sits in her lap and wanders around. And the first time we were there, she was saying that she had dropped an earring about a week ago and couldn't find it. And we looked everywhere. She had had her housekeeper look. And about 10 minutes later, I heard something in the bedroom and went in, and Tigger had gotten the earring out from under her bed and slapped it into the living room for her.
Oh, my gosh.
He is just marvelous, and anyone who believes cats don't have souls probably don't have souls themselves.
Oh, John.
Well, I think, that's really where most Americans are in their thinking. Mm-hmm. You know, I think they really are very attached to the animals and love them very much and appreciate them and attribute all kinds of miraculous things to them. Mm. And it could well be true. I mean, I don't think there's any question that animals have souls. I think the question is really how we perceive them. These questions to me are interesting about whether we're superior or inferior. I think to me we're just different. And I think whenever we start telling people or thinking we know what's going on in a dog or cat's mind, that to me is when a little bell goes off, because I think in order to do that, we need to understand how those minds work. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that.
Thanks, Kathy. James from Madison. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I'm enjoying your show very much. I'm an animal lover, especially cats. And in the Hebrew Bible, the animal's spirit is called the nefesh. So the Bible does talk about the animals having a spirit. And I wanted to make one comment about people who don't like cats. I'm always suspicious of people who don't like cats, because usually the reason they don't like cats is because cats are aloof, they're independent, they're not like the slavish dog. So I don't trust people that don't like cats.
John.
I think there's a lot of interesting studies about the difference between dog and cat lovers, and they're very different. And people tend to love dogs because they see them as being dependent and reliable.
Yes.
They love cats, of course, because they're more independent, and that attracts some people in a different way. And again, it goes back to what we're about more as much as the animal. It goes back to our needs. I mean, we get the animals we need, and we project onto them what we want.
Mm-hmm.
I go back to the question about the Hebrew Bible. You know, there are a lot of biblical references to the spirits of animal in Christianity as well, and also in the Muslim faith. But Christianity and Judaism do not ascribe human souls to animals, and Judaism doesn't deal with the heaven question really at all. So this question of whether the souls are kind of equivalent, the only religion I know of that does that is Buddhism, which as an earlier caller I think was referring to, gives all living things a spirit and sees them all being on more or less an equal plane. If you're getting away from the religious ideas about it, as the caller is mentioning, people have very strong feelings about what species they like and what they're doing to them. And you hear through the thread of the calls, look at the things that are being attributed to these animals. I mean, they're almost supernatural creatures. That's where I think we're really going with it, is we're that's what I mean when I say we're worshiping animals and not people, is that, you know, you don't hear a dog or cat ever being criticized, which is fine, but you hear this disenchantment with people. And I think that's what's really driving a lot of it. It makes it very interesting.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting, the animals that have come in your life and what they've done for you, too. We only have a minute left, but I'd like for you to talk a wee bit about Lenore, who we've neglected this hour, unfortunately.
We have neglected the Hound of Love. She's going to be the subject of three children's books, too.
Oh, is she really?
Yeah, she's what the children's books are about. Lenore is that amazingly, she's a black lab, and she came at a time in my life that, a difficult year. And she shows to me the power of a dog to just open up a channel in you and change you if you're open to it. And again, she didn't do it consciously, but she did it.
Mm-hmm.
She really kept love alive, is the way I keep thinking of her, and made me appreciate it. And I used to sing to her at night, and we still do, as a matter of fact. And she loves to be in my lap, and it generates this feeling you're talked about with your dog and other callers have talked about with their animals. They really open up a channel of love and affection that's extraordinarily powerful in us and that we seem to need very much. I certainly do, and it sounds like a lot of your callers do. And it's a great challenge to kind of have some perspective on it when it's so important.
John, thank you so much for being with us again.
I enjoyed it. Sorry for my little throat thing there, but I rallied.
Yeah, you did rally. Sounded good. Sounded good.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, our great pleasure. John Katz. The book is Soul of a Dog, Reflections on the Spirits of the Animals of Bedlam Farm. Just been published, and we thank him for being with us. And thanks to you for all of your great calls this hour as well. Carmen Jackson produced the hour. Thank you, Carmen. Rob Schroeder, on air production here in Milwaukee. Thank you, Rob, for that. And thanks all around. Thanks to everybody. I'll be with you again on Monday, all things political, Monday at 9. And just a reminder that our healthcare live broadcast is Wednesday, and that will be from the Cancer Center at Fratert for a full 2 hours. It should be a great show, so mark it down. Thanks for listening. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.